Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am speaking to the amazing registered veterinary technician, Aaron Davis, all about team building and best practices in vet med, how corporations can recruit and retain with compassion and stability, how we can train our practice leaders for success, how independent practices can compete in this atmosphere of a lot of corporations. So many interesting words of wisdom from Aaron. You guys don't want to miss it. Hi, Aaron. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Tabitha. Thank you for having me.
So I met Aaron. It's a small vet med world, and we already knew each other through socials. And then I had the pleasure of meeting him via Zoom, which is like meeting people in real life at this point, when I helped his practice become fear-free certified that he was working at, because he's a boss. So we had a chance to meet at VMX in person. It was amazing. He's amazing. So of course, I had to have him on the podcast. And his career path is a little different than some other veterinary technicians and where he's working at now. So could you start by sharing with the guest a little bit about you and how you got to where you are today and the topic we're going to be talking about?
Yeah, certainly. So my name is Aaron. I use he, they pronouns. I have been working in vet med since my very first job when I was 14 years old. I got an after school job at the one practice in my town, working in the barn and working in the kennels. From there, I moved my way into a larger vet assistant role. And eventually, by the time I was 20, found myself working in emergency medicine, which I carried for about 10 to 12 years, give or take. At the time, growing up in Texas, I was not someone who went to tech school, but I did find myself in the role of a technician. Back in the day, I think we called those uncredentialed technicians, but now, you know, I recognize that I was just in a very high value veterinary assistant role. From there, you know, I went into hospital management, hospital leadership. I've worked as a hospital manager for both ER specialty medicine and small animal GP. Recently, I found myself moving into the corporate space, and I'm now a recruiter and campus outreach coordinator for Destination Pet, which is a national vet brand based out of Denver.
What an awesome path, starting in barns as a veterinary assistant at 14. Damn. And then still strong in vet med, from working in ER to practice management. What influenced you to make the jump to retention, the job you're at now? I mean, recruiting. Okay. See?
Yeah. Recruiting and retention.
Well, it is retention though. Yeah.
Those two go hand in hand. You know, you can recruiting is taking a bucket and getting the water out of the sinking boat. Retention is plugging the hole. So those two go hand in hand. But to answer your question, first and foremost, it was my knees and my back and my hips that told me that your days of running around a busy ER and your days of bending down and getting back up are numbered. I can get down. It's getting back up. That's the hard part. But more so, I found myself really developing a lot of soft skills that I became passionate about, like communication, you know, clinical team engagement, building, you know, healthy and compassionate practice cultures. These areas became really, really important to me. And as I developed these skills, I found myself wanting to support more people and more practices from a macro level. So one of my dearest friends, Catherine Smith, who is the director of recruiting at Destination Pet, we've known each other for about 15 years, and she recruited me into this role, knowing that I just have a really fun time networking and building relationships. And, you know, I call it veterinary matchmaking.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it really allows me to, you know, talk to a lot of people, spread the gospel of good culture to a lot of people, and, you know, build healthy relationships between my company and the community that we serve.
And for people who may not be familiar with a veterinary recruiter and helping to build cultures at healthy practices, What does that position look like? So you attending different schools and networking and recruiting, but what else would you say you were doing in your position?
So essentially my goal was to hire doctors. And as most of the people listening know, that is, you know, one of our biggest struggles right now as an industry is recruiting, hiring, and retaining doctors. I work also with credentialed technicians and veterinary support professionals as well. And I spend a lot of time visiting campuses, building relationships with the student organizations and the student bodies, you know, bringing engagement opportunities to them, building out our externship platform so we can bulk up that pipeline to post-graduation hires. And, you know, I spend a lot of time at the conferences, just building the brand, building the relationship, connecting vendors with the company. So it really just kind of is like a like an all around matchmaking gig, which I love.
No, you are perfect for it. And I know that in the process of you, because we've talked about this, in the process of you working in vet med, and obviously we've all worked in clinics or environments that weren't necessarily conducive to learning, and there was a lot of toxicity, and culture was a word that was said, and building in and family, ugh, that word triggers all of us, which unfortunately it shouldn't. That's kind of a bummer, but I love that you found your niche because you're so good at this, and recruiting, retention, and building a positive culture and not toxic positivity, right? A true culture where veterinary professionals want to stay at a clinic is something that you love doing. And I'm so glad that Destination Pets found you. They're very lucky. But that's a really good segue into what I wanted to talk a little bit about you with you first. So when it comes to veterinary corporations versus general practices, how, in your experience, how has that been different as far as recruiting veterinarians for like non-corporate versus corporate? Because this is a huge topic in vet med, and I'll be honest, I'm not super hip with all of it. So I know that there's some negativity that comes with corporations, but also like we talked about at VMX, this is where our field is going. So we need to embrace it and they need to be held accountable. We're not going to just justify them not paying us or giving us benefits. But how have you approached working with corporate vets and also family-owned vets, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question because those strategies definitely look different for a large corporation or a veterinary consolidator, as you call them, or, you know, I hear some people calling them a national vet brand. Their strategy and their, you know, what they bring to the table is going to look a lot different than an independent practice. And, you know, the numbers are definitely changing rapidly in terms of the percent of the market share that is owned by consolidators versus independent practices. Some estimates are saying that it's going to reach about 50-50 in 2023. Some estimates say that it's even more than that already. But, you know, the veterinary consolidators are here to stay. And if we can't, you know, go back to an age of independently owned everything, we should at least be able to provide good relationships with our consolidators. We should build good culture there, and we should provide good opportunities for our industry. So when I think of the pros and cons of working for a consolidator, and that's going to be different for everybody, but what they often bring to the table is, you know, better benefits, more robust support, and just, you know, bigger and wider opportunities for advancement, bigger and wider opportunities for engagement. Those independent practices, you know, they have a really hard time competing in terms of benefits, in terms of perks, in terms of, you know, what they can offer their teams for in terms of advancement or pathways to advancement. And what they can offer, though, is a really great local unique culture. Keep in mind that a lot of people that are looking for jobs specifically want to work with an independent practice or specifically want to work with a large corporation or consolidator. A lot of people go into their job hunt knowing that one or the other is preferred for them. But for those that are on the fence, you know, you might find going to an independent practice gives you a lot of autonomy, gives you a chance to, you know, really be involved in your local community, really be involved in your in building the culture of that practice. And folks that want to go with a big consolidator, they might be looking at, you know, what's your 5-year plan? What's your 10-year plan? What are my opportunities for, you know, getting out of a clinical role if that's ever something that I'm thinking about? And what can they offer in terms of benefits and perks and whatnot?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was working in general practice, that was a few years ago, and I have only worked for one corporate vet, and that was a very long time ago when there were very few. And now that they're coming up every minute, I'm hearing about a new one. And I do tend to hear a lot of negative, but also I'm starting to hear more positive because I think as a culture and society, they're understanding that, hey, yes, we want appropriate pay and benefits and time off, but also we want individualized medicine for each patient. We want a connection with the patients and clients and each other. And I know there's a disconnect sometimes with that with corporate, not always, none of this is always, but like you were saying, you may look for a locally owned practice if community is something more that's more important to you. But I am seeing more corporations understand the importance of community or saying they do, maybe not doing the actions, which is a problem in all fields. But when it comes to corporations recruiting and retaining staff members or even family-owned practices, or what's the term I should be saying, Aaron?
So you can call them vet consolidators and independent practices.
Thank you, love. That's what I meant. With your experience and all of your knowledge, how do you feel like they can recruit and retain people, staff members, vets, vet techs, with compassion and stability? Because that is a really huge problem in vet med that unfortunately, we're starting to acknowledge, but also it's been a problem for quite a long time. And for some of those reasons are complex, but they are obvious. But we're finally starting to acknowledge them, which again, once we notice something, we can work on improving it. But
yeah, well, I think, you know, you brought up a good point that a lot of these consolidators do have, you know, really good values, really good intentions. They're working to build really good internal culture because they do recognize the importance of that. But you also have some where what they're advertising doesn't necessarily match what is taking place on the inside. And what I will just say on that is we are in an age now to where information is readily available. Social media is, you know, the primary avenue for sharing information, you know, sharing knowledge in this aspect. And we're dealing with, you know, a young labor market made up of mostly like millennials and Gen Z at this point, who are, you know, very well informed. They're very good at finding out, you know, the details that they want. They're very good at finding out if these companies do match the values that they're sharing, and if we're values aligned. And, you know, I think a lot of people more and more are making decisions based on value these days. So I would just say to the consolidators and even the independent practices, you know, make sure that what you're promoting and make sure that what you're broadcasting is something that you can really back up in a strong sense, because that's going to go a long way in building trust, building loyalty with the workforce that you're trying to recruit. You know, when we get into priorities that I hear doctors and technicians telling me about when I'm doing recruiting, a lot of the young grads or a lot of the new grads are really, you know, prioritizing finding a good mentor. I think it's really important to them coming out of school that they have a strong mentor at the practice that they're going to be at, someone that's going to really take them under their wing and share knowledge, share information, share experience. We're seeing fewer and fewer vet school graduates doing a rotating internship compared to 10 years ago. So whereas someone would normally go to like your Blue Pearl or your AMC and do a 12-month rotating internship out of school, now, you know, just because of the high cost of education, a lot of these folks are going straight into practice. So they're missing out on that, you know, that 12 months of really intense clinical training. And their trade-off is for them to hopefully find a practice with a mentor that's going to share, you know, information, not in the same speed, but it's going to really, like I said, take them under their wing, give them one-on-one attention, and hopefully build a relationship that's going to last, you know, quite a while. You know, a mentorship relationship should be anywhere from 3 months to a year minimum. You know, hopefully if it's worthwhile, that's going on for, you know, longer and longer in an informal sense. You know, more than that, I think doctors are really looking for flexibility. That seems to be a big one that I get, especially in New York City where I live and primarily recruit for. You know, in a post-pandemic world, our doctors are learning that they don't want to just sit around at home all the time, that they want to take every opportunity to travel. You know, all of a sudden we're paying doctors a lot more than we were, and they want to invest that extra income in seeing the world. So how easy are we making it for doctors to get away from clinics? How easy are we making it for them to take time off? How easy are we making it for them to do that and not lose income, not lose production, not lose, you know, PTO time? Those are really important. I would say, you know, from a support staff side, from a technician side, engagement. You know, how often and how well are you engaging your clinical teams, from the leaders of your organization all the way down? Are we building good relationships with them? Are we making them feel a sense of belonging? Are we making them feel a sense of agency in their practice? I'd say those are probably the top three, but there's a lot of other tips that we can offer for recruiting and retention too.
No, I definitely agree with that. I've worked with a few amazing veterinary professionals who went on to go to vet school, and they are now amazing vets. And I remember having really in-depth conversations with all three of them, and all three, and this was like 4 years ago, and they were asking me about local clinics, because that's another thing, guys, we talk. This is a normal thing. So even if you are as a company,
small industry, and we are very vocal about our feelings.
I love about our field.
Absolutely.
Obviously there's a specific approach to that, but they were my friends and they were looking for practices, and they know that, for example, a lot of my values are equal to their values. And we've all worked at clinics where we've taken all this time, especially as a veterinarian, the additional steps that they had to take. We've taken all this time to get interviewed, to go through contracts. And then we were very clear with our expectations and what we needed. And then 3 months into it, you're like, this was unfortunately a complete waste of my time. And I was really clear with what I needed and wanted. So I remember her. I was so proud of her. But she mentioned how she needs a mentor, and she defined what a mentor was to her. And she was like, yes, this place is paying more, but I'm literally going to just be thrown to the fire and get burnt out in 2 seconds. And she worked as a veterinary assistant prior to going to vet school. And the other two worked as technicians prior to going to vet school. And I think that actually is why their approach to finding a job was so much different, because they were already aware of some of that false narrative stuff, unfortunately, that is being fed out in interview, like the family thing, right?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I think having that clinical experience, you know, as a support professional is really helpful, and understanding what your priorities should be, or understanding what your goals should be. And Tabitha, real quick, I just want to, you know, on the topic of mentorship, I just want to also point out that when we talk about mentorship, we're not talking about the initial training period for that doctor or that technician or that support professional. Those are two separate things that should take place, you know, independently of each other. Your mentorship is a long-term relationship. It does not replace having a, you know, 1 to 3 month training or onboarding period, especially for new graduates. They are not coming into your practice ready to see cases on day one. They are not coming into your practice ready to do their own workups. They are coming directly from an academic institution where they've maybe had, you know, 12 to 18 months of clinical rotations. But, you know, we want to make sure that we are providing a really good safety net for these doctors. so that they can build their practice confidence, so that they can build their skills, and so that they can feel confident to see cases, you know, usually 1 to 3 months, but focus that on the individual. If they need more time, give them more time, because long term, they're going to be bringing in a lot of revenue for your practice. So it's worth it to invest, you know, a good training period up front, and then separately help them build a relationship with a mentor that's going to work with them, that's going to guide them, that's going to provide feedback over, you know, the course of hopefully around 12 months or longer, again, depending on the individual and depending on the relationship.
Yeah. And I think it all kind of coincides with each other, as far as if you have a good mentorship, whether we call it a program or just, because let's be honest, teaching is not everyone's strong suit. That doesn't mean you still can't be an amazing mentor, because I've had some amazing mentors who their teaching styles were different than mine, but still they were really amazing. And by providing this healthy, safe environment, like you said, the safety net, you're really setting them up for success. You're helping increase their confidence. You're helping prevent, I mean, things from happening, whether it's bad medicine, which nobody's perfect. We all do things that isn't perfect. Setting that precedence, for example, saying, hey, you're not going to know everything, and that's normal. Can we please say that and normalize that in vet med? But by doing that, you're also actually kind of creating an environment where they want to stay, right? And that they have a clear understanding of their role, their job duties, and then also a pathway to advancement. Because I know there's so many, especially support staff, who we get stuck. I mean, I can't tell you how many veterinary technicians I've met who feel stuck. And a big part of that is not feeling a sense of belonging, which if you have a mentorship program or a mentor, you're going to feel connected with that clinic and with that staff. And you're going to care more about your job. Again, it's a win-win for everybody. But also, I know so many support staff who have no pathway to advancement. And when they ask about it, they get punished. And then everyone's like, why did one tech leave and the rest of the staff left? They did that maliciously. No, they didn't. Because this happens. This happened in many clinics I worked at, where one of us left and the rest of us left. And it wasn't malicious. It was trigger stacking. This is months to years of us asking, expressing our concerns, not being heard, not being validated, no opportunity for growth, and being actually punished for asking for opportunity. I remember I did interview in another place, but it was a behavior specific gig for a veterinary behaviorist. And as everyone knows, guys, I'm kind of into behavior. And I was very clear. I was very clear. Like, I did a lot for this practice. I implemented Fear Free. I started offering behavior services. I did a lot with minimal support. And I told the owner, I have an interview. I can't not do this. And I was berated for like an hour. And I will never forget. Obviously, I'm still a little troubled by it.
Tell us how you feel.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons, guys, I left general practice. And, you know, that was a lot of my experiences. No opportunity for improvement, no mentorship, no support, no flexibility. All the three things that essentially, obviously, it's a lot more complex than that. But that's a really good place to start. And as far as belonging, because obviously we all have different definitions of what that may feel like for us. But from your position, where you're dealing with tons of people, as far as what they feel belonging is as a veterinarian or support staff, what does that entail? And how can a practice help to create a culture where the staff feels like they belong there?
Yeah. So belonging, like I said earlier, belonging ties hand in hand with retention. Belonging is, at its very essence, that the feeling that I belong here, the feeling that I matter to this practice, that I matter to this hospital, that I matter to this company, and the feeling that I can come to work and I can make a difference. That's really important to people. No one wants to just come and be a cog in the machine. People want to come to work, especially, you know, animal healthcare providers. We are passionate about what we do. We're passionate about our patients. We want to come and make a difference every day. So that sense of belonging is how much do I feel like I can actually make a difference here? It ties into psychological safety. How comfortable am I to speak up in this environment? How comfortable am I to disagree in this environment? And in terms of support professionals, which I want to shout out Liz Houston for mentioning veterinary support professionals or VSPs the other day as a great way to recognize our support staff. I've been using that phrase nonstop since I saw that.
Love it.
So VSPs or veterinary support professionals, yes, they want pathways to advancement. And a lot of times your practice manager or your leaders are going to be hesitant to offer those. And the reason for that is because staffing vet practices is just so hard these days. Finding good people is even harder. And when you see these good people come in and you invest in them in a clinical sense, and now they're talking about, you know, wanting to move on to something else, that's really hard because you may not be easy to replace on the clinic floor. And ultimately, for a veterinary corporation, you know, there's so many people involved in that. But unless you're physically on the clinic floor, unless you're putting hands on a patient, or unless you're engaging clients directly, you're not really involved in revenue generation, right? As a recruiter, I can go away tomorrow and nothing will really change in terms of revenue for the hospital. The P&L won't change. But if I'm a veterinarian or if I'm a technician and I go away, that affects the revenue. That affects the growth of the practice. So, you know, managers are not going to be as inclined to offer pathways to advancement unless they know that they can comfortably backfill that slot. But I think it's a really great idea for us to offer soft skill training for our clinical teams. Those are the skills, like I said earlier, that I really started to develop. And that's when I started seeing myself have opportunities outside of the clinic floor. Communication training. 90% of the problems that we face in vet med are communication related. You know, most of your client complaints, even when it's related to financial concerns with that, you know, the cost is too high, that's too expensive. These are, you know, they sound like finance concerns, but they're really communication concerns. 100%. And if we can teach better communication skills, if we can teach better conflict resolution skills, if we can teach better organization skills to our clinic teams, they're going to be more successful in that environment. They're going to feel more confident in their job role, and that's going to lend to more of a sense of belonging. I spent the early part of my career as an overnight ER tech. So if you think that I've always been a great communicator, or if you think I've always had such great conflict resolution skills, buddy, I got to tell you something.
Right.
That is not the case. And I'm very fortunate and very privileged that I was able to teach myself these skills, but not many people have that opportunity. Not many people in a clinical setting, you know, especially when you get into, you know, like smaller towns or rural areas, there's just not those opportunities. So we should be offering, you know, skill development to our support professionals. We should be building a better hospital culture so that it's easier to recruit for that hospital, so that it's easier to, you know, keep people engaged in a clinical setting, keep people happier in a clinical role. And for those that do want to move up, for those that do want to do something more, we can give them those opportunities without fear that we're going to have a hard time replacing them. So it all really ties in together. And then for those that, you know, do want to move up, if your company has internal job recs, if your company, you know, if there's a corporate position that opens up, are you offering that internally first before you start promoting it outside? Are you making sure that every department in your home office team has people with clinical experience in it? Because that's really important.
That is so important. Yeah.
That's super important. We're seeing a lot of corporations come in and they're building up this really robust, you know, home office team of, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people supporting their clinicians through HR, through marketing, through legal. You know, there's culture and wellness teams being developed. There's DEI teams. So there's a lot of opportunities, but do we have people with clinical experience in all of those teams? You know, do we And I'm not saying every person on that team needs to come from a clinical role or come from vet med, but if you've got people, you know, on your marketing team that can help, you know, understand if this design is fear-free or not, or, you know, making sure that we're not sending out an ad with a doctor scruffing a cat. That's really valuable, right?
And I love that you mentioned that because he's like, I'm going to trigger Tabitha. Because I do, even if, like, my husband works for a human healthcare software thing. And they,
gotcha.
I know, he's great, guys. It's a human healthcare software. He creates software for hospitals on a very large scale. Because of course, human medicine, everything is computerized. We are getting there in vet med. Yay. But they have, my husband is amazing at what he does, but he also knows what he can't do. And his team, because again, it's a very large company, they have tons of nurses and doctors who they consult with. So when they're creating, hey, I'm creating a SOP or a soap that doctors need to fill out, you need to talk to a doctor. Or even honestly, I've learned so much, guys. So for example, there's like a salesperson that sells the software to the hospital. There's the people that create the software. There's the people that use the software. And it's really common for the person selling the software not necessarily share things that the IT company can actually make. So just that disconnect causes millions, I mean, in human industry, millions of dollars. Or they spend millions of dollars and hours creating something, and then a doctor uses it and the doctor's like, well, nope, this is not practical at all. So thankfully they have tons of human doctors and nurses.
Human veterinarians.
Yes, human veterinarians. I love it. On staff. So I can imagine the importance of that as, because again, it's interesting because I don't really think of the veterinarian medical team similar to the human, because there are a lot of change differences, but we are getting to the same level, which are good things. Like, we're keeping better records, we're communicating better, we're getting computerized and away from paper. A lot of good things.
We're becoming more organizational too.
Yes,
we're starting to treat our companies like actual organizations, you know, instead of just winging it and figuring it out as we go, which I think is a common trend in vet medicine. But you're right. It's so valuable to have those people on the team that can bridge the gap between clinical needs and overall industry possibilities. And that's not to say that you shouldn't have people that come from business, that come from, you know, a strictly marketing background. I think these people are great and they bring a lot of really robust skills with them. But they should be complemented by people that have those skills, but can also say, well, this is what it's like for the people working on the clinic floor. This is what it's like for that veterinarian or that technician. It's super helpful. And it gives you an opportunity to keep people in the industry and engaged. And it gives them a chance to, you know, if they do want to support the industry or if they do want to support practices on a larger scale, it gives them the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think so. That's, again, some positives of where our field is going as far as corporations. They have more resources for marketing, because it's kind of like when I started my own consulting business, Trips and Chatter. I'm not going to lie to you guys. I didn't know shit about business. And I know there's a lot of other, you know, veterinarians who are doing the same thing because there's minimal resources, or they don't realize that there are practice managers out there that can help them. We've all felt like that, because now I have other people that assist me in things and it's beautiful. But it took me a minute to get to that point, and I'm getting better at business. But a lot of it was learning on the job, which is not the best when you're a huge veterinarian practice. So I could see some positives of corporations as far as them having some resources available to make that transition easier. Now, should that transition look like we come in and X out everything that vet clinic was doing previously? And again, I'm not saying that's always. That's also not appropriate, and treating people like numbers, which, to be fair, I see done in all different types of practices. And that's where you kind of get back to that sense of belonging, treating each person like a, I mean, it sounds very simple, but guys, treating each person like a human, and feeling like they're valued in their position. Because also when we're doing this, we're also addressing ethical compromises that we already have so many that we have to deal with in even in a safe place as veterinary professionals. So when you have a support team that you feel that you belong, you're safe to ask questions, you're going to be able to better cope with stressors that are going to come up. And I think including myself, I did not have coping skills that were healthy to deal with the stressors of
that took me a while to develop too.
Yeah. And I would have loved those, like like you mentioned, those communication skills, those conflict resolution skills. Like now I have them because I got into behavior, but that would have been like life changing, not just for me at work, but dealing with stress
in a general sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally, emotionally. Oh my gosh. Like that's, I just love that you brought that up because I've, crazily enough, I've never even heard of such a thing in a practice, but I know it's out there. Aaron's letting me know and he's spreading the word, which is great.
Yeah, but I want to, Tabitha, you brought up a good point just a minute ago when you said, you know, how are, as consolidators, how are we coming in and how are we engaging with our clinical teams? You know, like, are we coming in and dictating medicine? Are we coming in and dictating patient care? And that's, I think, really huge for consolidators to understand is getting their engagement right. This is where I think independent practices have the leg up, because when you go to work for an independent practice, you have a lot more autonomy. You know, you really only have one boss, and that boss is hopefully going to be someone that wants people here that are going to steer the culture, that are going to steer the conversation, that are going to steer the medicine. So you've got a much smaller team, and everyone, you know, if you're doing it right, everyone should have a really strong voice in that organization. When you start working with consolidators and bigger, you know, national vet brands or bigger groups, that autonomy can shrink a little bit, and that voice can get, you know, drowned out a little bit more in the sea of many, many more voices. So I talk to my team all the time about engagement, engagement, engagement. And I think I say that word, you know, probably enough times in a week to where some people are like, that word doesn't make sense to me anymore because you've said it so many times. But, you know, like when you say spaghetti over and over again, and you're like, is that still the same word? But I do. I think engagement is probably the number one tool that you can use to build that sense of belonging. And I want to talk about that in kind of two different ways. One is, you know, what is our engagement culture like as a consolidator? Because again, independent practices, you know, you've got the leg up on engagement. So as a consolidator, how much oversight do I have on the day-to-day operations of the practice? How much oversight do I have on what that practice looks like? You're going to have a lot more success if you're building strong teams that you can trust and rely on and give them the resources for success, right? Like when I go and visit practices in my network, I don't go in and tell them how to run the show. We don't go in and tell them how to run the show. We go in and we say, what do you need to be successful for this practice? You know, giving them practice autonomy while at the same time giving them access to trainings, giving them access to development, giving them access to resources so that they can build a good medical quality and a good patient care quality. And, you know, stepping in, obviously, if there are discrepancies, you know, if you've got a practice and they're like punching dogs in the face, you want to do something about that.
Yes.
But if it's a practice where, like, you know, they're protocols are like slightly different than what you're expecting, if it's not causing patient harm, if it's not causing, you know, client disloyalty, maybe consider just letting them do what they're good at and letting them practice in a way that is, you know, beneficial to them and their communities. So that's kind of like engagement as a structure for an organization. When we talk about direct engagement, this is, you know, how are you connecting the leaders in your company to the clinical workers in your practice?
Right.
Again, the only people that generate revenue for a veterinary industry are the people that are practicing medicine, physically touching patients, or physically, you know, directly engaging clients. everyone else is, you know, in terms of revenue, everyone else is pretty unessential, but the people that are on the clinic floor, they're super essential. So how are we engaging everyone in that clinic? How are we making them know their leaders? How are we making them know what's going on with the company? How are we giving them access to education, giving them access to CE, giving them access to development? I think, you know, companies like Veg have a really good handle on that. You know, Veg is large national brands. They're growing really rapidly. They're ER and urgent care only, but they engage their clinical teams very, very well. The leaders, you know, all the way up in that organization, they know the people on the floor. Everyone has everyone's contact information. Everyone is able to contact each other. A lot of other organizations are seeing the value in that. So if your CEO is, you know, visiting practices, giving out their cell phone number, talking to people, not in a scary sense, but in a, you know, like, I want to get to know you. I want to know what's relevant to you. I want to know what's important to you.
I want to listen to you and not just come in and say things, but listen,
assess, absolutely,
sit back, and then maybe we could collect together on how to proceed in the future or whatever.
Absolutely. Giving people that voice, right? Like giving people a voice, making people feel like their voices matter, their concerns matter, and that they have access to their leaders, that they have access to information within their organization. That's huge. That's, I mean, an engagement costs very, very little. And it goes a long way in building that sense of belonging. So, you know, if you are a national vet brand leader, or if you're someone in a leadership role, especially if you're in the C-suite or the V-suite, if you don't get anything else out of this podcast episode, engage your teams, engage your clinical teams, show up, build relationships with them, give them your phone number, problem solve. You know, if you can walk into that building and if you can solve a problem for them that actually matters to them, that might be dealing with a client complaint. That might be helping, you know, that might be fixing a squeaky door. I've walked into practices before where, you know, I hear the practice manager complaining. They're like, oh, if I could just get that damn door to stop squeaking, I'm going to just run out and I'm going to buy some WD-40 and I'm going to come back and I'm going to fix that squeaky door because it doesn't cost me anything. I'm already here. I'm already showing up. And, you know, if I can eliminate a pesky noise, then hopefully that's a problem that I can solve that people are going to, you know, that's going to build loyalty and trust.
No, that's a really great example, because I think sometimes people hear engagement or building up a beautiful culture and they just shut down and think that it's these humongous steps that there's no way they could do. And that is not the case. Like just being, and then also being genuine, right? So I think there's a really good example. I can't remember. It's been in so many lectures I've been to, but it was essentially someone saying, it was a soccer coach talking to girls, and what he was saying was the right words. He was like, great job, blah, blah, blah. But learning history, he tends to focus on the negative and doesn't focus on the positive and doesn't give them constructive criticism. So in that moment, yes, he said, good job one time, but also the way he was saying it, his arms were crossed, his body language was tense. And I think that that happens more often than we realize, where especially I'm sure all of us who've worked in GP and work in practice have noticed where you go to the staff meeting, there's some pizza or whatever, and they're like, great job, guys. And you're just like, that is an empty, like it's actually insulting sometimes that they're saying it, because they're not genuine. There's no engagement otherwise. There's no transparency or accountability for what they say they're going to do. So I think I love those practical steps. Like if a rep came in and fixed a door, I would legit be like, I want to sell all your products. I love you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's my credit card. Let me go fire my other reps. You're the one.
But thank you so much for being here. Such a small, just being a kind, genuine person. And listen, like actively listening, not not engaging with them in a way where it feels forced, which I think we've all probably experienced. But I love those points that you brought up and how this is something that any, a larger or a smaller practice can do and honestly needs to do to build this positive culture.
Absolutely. And you might not find those relationships develop on the first visit. You know, if I'm a vet assistant and I've never met my CEO before and she walks in the door, you know, I might not open up to her on that first visit. I might think, oh, crap, someone's getting fired or, you know, right, something's going down here. And I might not be really open. But if she shows up or if he shows up, men can be CEOs too. Then I, you know, show up, engage, problem solve. You know, eventually I'm going to let my guard down and I'm going to feel more relaxed around them. But it might take a few visits. I'm a fan of, if you're in the C-suite of your organization, every member of the C-suite should visit every center in your organization once a year. And that sounds like a lot, right? Because some of these organizations have 30 practices. Some of these organizations have thousands of practices. And for the ones that have thousands, you might not be able to hit every one of them every year, but you should be making a damn good effort. Vice presidents, you should be, you know, aiming for 50 to 75% of your practices. Director level people, you should be aiming for 25 to 50% of your practices. You know, and get your marketing people out in the field. Get your marketing people to go to conferences. Get your HR and your legal people in the field so they can see what it's like inside a vet practice. You know, everyone, but especially people that don't come from clinical experience, should be visiting these practices and should be learning and educating themselves on what, you know, what the needs are of an hourly employee working on the clinic floor.
Yeah, I think that that is all wonderful. And then as far as independent practices, when it comes to some of the things that we've kind of talked about, because there's pros and cons with everything, but when it comes to independent practices, how can they compete in the atmosphere where our field is moving towards, I guess? What are a few things that you could, obviously all the things you touched on already are important in all practices, but as far as independent practices competing in the atmosphere we're currently in, what are a few things you could recommend?
Yeah, so for independent practices, it's really important to, you know, for one, manage your costs well, right? Because your costs are going to be much higher than a consolidator that has, you know, cheaper HR solutions, cheaper onboarding opportunities, cheaper payroll, cheaper everything. So manage your costs really, really well. But at the same time, think about anything you can do to leverage technology in your centers, because you want to be really focused on patient care, patient quality, and medical quality. The way that you do that is to make sure that your team, which is probably going to be a lot smaller than a big corporate giant, that your team is able to come to work every day and just do patient care or just practice medicine or just do, you know, client relationships. If it can be automated, automate it. If it can be outsourced, you know, at a reasonable cost, do it so that you can really focus on high quality medicine, high quality relationships, building ties with your community. You know, there are a lot of people in this day and age that will walk past Starbucks and go two blocks down the road to an independent coffee shop because they're independent or because they have ties with their community or because, you know, they support queer organizations, Black organizations, whatever it may be. You want to really lean into your values and lean into your community relationships. You may not be able to offer the same kind of benefit as a big giant. You may not be able to offer, you can't compete on healthcare. You probably can't compete on 401k, but you can offer a lot more flexibility in scheduling. You can offer a lot more flexibility in, you know, time away from work. I've seen some practices offer, you know, an annual PTO stipend for volunteering. So we're going to give everyone two or three days off a year that you can go and volunteer either for an organization that the practice has a relationship with, or you can pick your own. And that's, yeah, I think that's super cool. I would absolutely love an opportunity to get paid to spend a couple of days a year doing volunteer work. That builds a relationship with your community that builds loyalty with your neighbors. And that gets people, you know, choosing to come to your practice because of the ties that you're creating.
That is all amazing. So I'm just going to summarize a few of the amazing tips you shared with us today. So how corporations can recruit and retain with compassion and stability. Engagement. I need to make a shirt with engagement for Aaron. Direct clinical.
You have a megaphone on it.
I know, engagement. Right? Oh, I love it. It's crucial, of course, to build a sense of belonging. Routine direct communication. Ample CE and development opportunities, which this can be growth for, hey, I'm a technician. I want to be a practice manager. Or this could be, I want to be a better technician because we're always improving and growing.
And on that note, for the independent practices, but even for the consolidators, leverage your vendors for CE opportunities.
Yes.
There is no shortage of free and race-approved CE opportunities out there. And you can find that information on social media. You can find that information online. But your vendors are great resources for that. When I was a practice manager, I did a weekly newsletter for my staff, which if you can batch your communications, do that. I did that instead of sending them an email every time.
I love that so much.
So I would send them a roundup email on Sunday or Monday. And part of that email would include some free CE opportunities. And it would be my MWI rep, my Elanco rep, my IDEX or my Antec rep. You can get those emails and you can just consolidate that and just offer it, you know, and if it's something that is taking place during clinic hours, consider if you've got really strong engagement around that, if you've got people excited about that, consider blocking off that time and letting them, you know, come together and do an hour of CE. That missed appointment or those two missed appointments, you know, you're going to make up for that in engagement, in belonging, and just in skill growth for your team.
No, that's a really good point. And one of my good memories of working in GP was we would see a case, because you see tons of cases all day, every day. And we would have a little box. It was a smaller practice. And we would talk through one case a week. Ideally, we would do more, but you have to start somewhere. And people could put the cases that they possibly wanted to talk about, because obviously they're all interesting, but there's different ones. And whatever had the most votes, or we would just pick one out at random. And then we would talk through the case with the veterinarian, the CSRs, the support staff, and what medicine was involved, why those choices were made. I felt safe asking questions. Why did you choose this medication over this medication? Because this medication has blah, 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 blah. So not only was I feeling really engaged and connected and not me versus them, which unfortunately with CSR and techs and vets, that's a very real thing, or vets and techs. So it was a very simple exercise that we did 30 minutes once a week. And we talked about a case. I learned so much, and it kind of helped to teach me more critical thinking skills, which thankfully I have quite a few now. But I know many of us, including myself, I've worked in practice and I'm like, I'm giving this medication because this is what we do. That is not great. I want to understand why I'm giving this medication, what this medication is going to do. So that's another super simple thing. And you might realize that one of the team members actually has a really great suggestion for the future.
That's huge.
Yeah. And you're creating an environment where if I'm unsure about something, let's say I'm unsure about a medication because of whatever I know about that medication, and that vet might have wrote the wrong dose wrong, or the wrong dose, because we all are, again, no one's perfect. I feel comfortable saying, hey, are you sure this is the dose you want? Because we know there's tons of research in human medicine to support the amount of severe tragedies and accidents that happen. But the nurses and the other staff were aware of it, but they were so afraid to say anything that these things happen. So again, I'm sure it happens in vet med all the time. We just don't have as much research, of course. But
it absolutely does. And what you're talking about, Tabitha, is psychological safety. And like we said,
yes, you said that word earlier. I love that.
Psychological safety is, in a nutshell, how safe do I feel to disagree in this environment? How safe do I feel to speak up and to speak out on something. And having weekly rounds like that is amazing. It's a great educational opportunity. It's a great way for the team to learn. It's a great way to build psychological safety. Having morning huddles with your team is great too. If you're not starting your day with a morning huddle, I would highly suggest looking into that. Huddles are great for, you know, going through the appointment schedule, double checking the day, making sure there's not missed opportunities for appointments, or making sure there's not opportunities to move things around. You know, like, oh, hey, that could be a tech appointment, move that over. Oh, hey, we need to make sure that that client gives her gabapentin in the morning or gives her thyroid meds ahead of that lab check. But more importantly than that, you know, and also huddles are a great way if you have a fear-free practice or if you are bringing fear-free into your practice to, you know, make sure that you've got accommodations appropriate throughout the day. You know, are you checking those behavioral questionnaires and, you know, making sure that you're doing the accommodations the right way? Are you talking through, you know, challenging cases? But more importantly than that, it's a great way to start the day with psychological safety. Because when you're doing these huddles, you have the opportunity to go around and do a check-in. I want to shout out one of my technicians at my former practice, Xylia, for coming up with the happy crappy technique.
Oh yeah, I saw that you did this. I love this when I interviewed his practice. This was the
coolest that's right.
Thing.
You did see one of our
huddles. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. I've never seen this before.
So so we would always start our huddles or end our huddles with a happy crappy. And that would be everyone would go around and say something this morning that makes you happy and something this morning that makes you feel crappy. And it's a great way to, you know, make sure that if anyone needs extra support today, they're going to get it. Or if anyone is just, you know, in a great mood and they're going to be the cheerleader or the champion for the day, you're in. But if I've got team members that are struggling, I want to know about that before the day starts, because I want to know that I might need to give this person extra time. I might need to give this person a chance to go take a walk. I might need to give this person, you know, make sure that they don't end up with a spicy client or make sure that they're just very well supported throughout the day. Another great way to do engagement kind of in a similar vein is to do, you know, critical event debriefs or rough day debriefs. We do this a lot in emergency medicine, following a code or following a really intense trauma case or following a, you know, a bloat or a GDV. You debrief at the end of that. It doesn't have to be right away. It can be whenever people are, you know, settled and in a good place, but you don't want to wait until the next day. You want it to be fresh. And it's just a really good chance to recap what happened, to share best practices, to talk about what went well, to talk about what could go better next time. But again, more importantly, to check in with your team. You know, we in vet med, we become very accustomed to going from a sad case or a euthanasia or, you know, having to tell a client that you've known for 10 years that their pet has cancer and then walk out of that room and go and give puppies a vaccine.
Right.
Right. And that's, yeah. We don't talk enough about the toll that that takes on us. We're, you might have just delivered the most devastating news of the month, and now you've got to walk out, take a deep breath, put a smile on, and go greet a puppy or a kitten. So having those critical event debriefs is really helpful in, you know, making sure that people are healthy, making sure that people are in a good headspace following that, and making sure that they have access to resources, you know, making sure that they know that there are peer groups out there, that there are you know, grief resources out there, that there are, you know, if you have an employee assistance program or if you have a wellness program, make sure that they have that, you reiterate those resources then. But that's, you know, that's super important. And building that psychological safety is really, really, really valuable in building that sense of belonging.
Those are such great suggestions, because I think we all know that, you know, mental health is a huge problem in the world in general, because mental health and physical health are along the same. But in vet med, there are a lot of mental health struggles that we're finally starting to somewhat address, or in animal welfare in general. I would love to see it more in the shelters that I work with. But thankfully, it's getting talked about. But for example, I deal with behavior euthanasias, where the most humane thing to do is because that animal, just like if you had an animal who had a severe medical issue that could not be managed and their quality of life was not good, this is the same. Mental health and physical health are the same. But that, don't get me wrong, is that really hard for me? Yes, 100%. Am I there for that caregiver and it's really hard for them? Because that's the other thing where I love that part about my job, being there for the caregivers from the start to the end. Whether this is I met you with your kitten and now your cat is 17 and dying of a disease process that we can no longer manage, or mental health again. I love being that person, but that is really heavy. And I think I might start doing this with my colleague. I work by myself and it sucks. It's the biggest thing I miss about, honestly, I miss the team that I had. Thankfully, I have amazing people in my life, like Aaron, because he's that person now and he knows it. And other people that I can call and talk to. But I love the idea of doing, I'm going to have to set up a group with my behavior folks.
Absolutely.
That is so good.
Especially if you work on your own, especially if you don't have that day-to-day, you know, support, access to your peers.
Yeah.
You should absolutely. And that doesn't have to only be, let's talk about sad cases or let's
celebrate wins.
Cases.
Like
that could be, yeah, that could be a weekly Zoom or a monthly Zoom or a bi-monthly whatever. And you can just get together and yeah, talk about successes. I think, you know, you're much more of a behavior professional than I am, but I, when I'm thinking of behavior and I'm thinking of fear-free, which I, you know, that I advocate very strongly for, I think I always tell people, talk about your successes, talk about your struggles, because it is a workshop style process. What works for one patient or what works in one situation doesn't necessarily work for the next one. And there's a lot of creative problem solving that goes on with behavior work that I really love. And the more opportunities you have to talk about that with your peers and hear what they tried and you're like, oh, that's weird, but that works. I'm going to use that. It's, you know, it, and again, I'm going to go back to that sense of belonging. You're building that sense of community. You're building that sense of, you know, like I fit in here and I've got people that I'm looking after and I've got people that are looking after me. So.
No, I love that. I think we've all stayed at teams longer than we may have. It might have not been best for us, but that, which again, that's where we should be working in vet med to create a healthy culture and all the things that Aaron was talking about. But I know many of us who've worked in possibly a toxic environment, but that team, you just didn't want to leave, which is a whole nother podcast episode. But essentially that tells you how strong. Well, I remember I would talk to a vet I worked with after work, and I remember one day we came to the conclusion that we were in an abusive relationship with our practice. And it was a really challenging conversation, but I'm so like, that was years ago, guys, very long time ago. I still remember that veterinarian and how she got me through some shit. Like, that's all I'm going to say. If I didn't have that person at that time, like, I love my partner. I thankfully have a great support system. And unfortunately, not everyone does outside of their job, let alone at their job. So I think that, of course, it always comes back to mental health because I think it's really important. But that sense of belonging will just, that is so strong that you'll stay in a toxic. I'm not saying you should, but I would.
Because we get trauma bonded to each other.
Yes, legit. Like, and so that sense of belonging is so important to the point where we would stay at a place. But again, we should be working towards all the other stuff as well.
And Tabitha, when we talk about belonging too, I want to also make sure that something that goes hand in hand with belonging and something that really all it ties in together and is super relevant to recruiting and super relevant to retention, and that is having strong diversity in your ranks and having a good, robust DEI or a diversity, equity, and inclusion platform in your organization. And that's something that's relevant to consolidators and independent practices. That's something that's really relevant to all of us. And for those that are not familiar, DEI work or diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, DEIB, is essentially the practice of making sure that your practice, that your business, that your hospital, that your corporation, whatever it may be, is one that champions and values diversity in terms of like ethnic, cultural, or gender, sexual, and romantic minorities. You know, do you have a lot of safety for like neurodiverse people and disabled people? Do you have people that look like the communities that you serve? Veterinary medicine is a very, very, very white profession. Mm-hmm. Veterinarians make up, I think the whitest professional group in terms of labor, you know, above farmers, above human physicians.
I did not know that.
It's a very, very, very white field.
I know it's very white, but I didn't know that. Always learning.
Yeah. And for an industry that is really dominated by women, there's still a lot of white male, ownership.
Yeah.
In terms of like who our CEOs are, who the people in our C-suite are, who our practice owners are. I would, you know, I saw a report recently that said 15% of people in vet med identify as queer. I would say that number is probably lower than what is accurate, but I might just be biased being in New York City. It's also an industry that brings a lot of neurodiverse people into it, right? Like,
definitely.
I think neurodiverse people are kind of natural caregivers, and we're natural animal lovers, and we naturally find ourselves seeking out these kind of roles. And when you talk about, you know, ethnic and cultural minorities in vet med, you know, it gets a little stark, because women of color make up about 2% of practice owners. And that is a really disproportionate number. When you start looking at ethnic and cultural diversity in vet med, it gets a little stark. We see a lot of our ethnic and cultural diversity at the clinic level in like CSR positions or vet assistant positions or porter positions. And not to say that those roles are not very valuable and that we shouldn't have diversity everywhere, but diversity should be a top-down process. One of the first things I do when I am looking at a new company, or if I'm, you know, when I'm on the job hunt, is I go to that website and I immediately go and look at who's in the C-suite. And if I see a lot of white men, you know, white, presumably cisgendered men, that doesn't speak to a lot of diversity.
Right.
Some companies will say, you know, we champion diversity. They'll release their labor stats and it'll be like, you know, 50% of our workforce is diverse, but they don't tell you that those are, you know, lower paid hourly positions, and their C-suite is made up of, you know, mostly white people. Diversity is super important because we have a lot of data right now. We have a lot of research and data that tells us in the general sense, companies that champion diversity are much more likely to overtake their competitors that are less diverse.
Yes.
Companies that champion diversity in a really robust sense from the top down are more successful. They have more retention. You know, retention is huge. That is what makes it easier for you to recruit and easier to maintain normal operations. So if you have more diversity, you know, all throughout your ranks, you're going to have a better chance of retaining those people and retaining everyone in your organization.
And you want clients to feel comfortable going
Absolutely.
There. Unfortunately, I've worked with a variety of clients who have shared some experiences with me that are really concerning. And I understand why they never want to go to a vet practice again. Because, for example, unfortunately, someone told them that their dog is racist, or unfortunately, some things that are commonly said. And I can understand why that person, and as I'm the first person meeting them as a dog trainer, and I have to break that down for them and apologize for what they've been told in the past. But I cannot imagine. And that's a common occurrence. Or I know a lot of clients who are Spanish speaking, and it's an area that has a lot of people who speak Spanish, yet those practices have not one person on staff that speaks Spanish. That is a fucking problem. Like, that is a huge problem. So obviously DEI is important. Because of what you mentioned earlier, we all want the world to be better and inclusive. We're all equal. We all matter. But unfortunately, we are in a world where some people don't believe that. And it's some of us don't feel safe going into specific spaces. And that's the last thing that we should be wanting to do in an environment or in a veterinary hospital or anywhere for that matter.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, to touch on that, I do want to point out that as a practice owner, especially if you're independent, but even more with the consolidators, you have the opportunity to build your own culture.
Yeah.
You have the opportunity to decide what the culture of your practice is. And especially in this day and age, you have the opportunity to decide what clients you're going to accommodate and which ones you're not. If your practice is booked up 2 weeks in advance or a week in advance, but you're struggling to keep staff in the door, what is the bigger motivation for you to support? Is it those clients, or is it your team that are, you know, directly affect your ability to produce revenue, your ability to operate? And as a practice manager, I took great joy in firing disrespectful or difficult clients that were, and not to say, you know, like, I want to be very, very careful here and make sure that we're not talking about emotional clients or clients that are invested in the health of their pet and are really scared or that don't have information. You know, a lot of times clients come in and they're scared. They've got a lot going on in their personal life. They're not as informed as we are about animal health care.
Right.
And those clients absolutely should be accommodated. They should be educated. They should be, you know, engaged in a compassionate sense. But if they're coming in and if they're being disrespectful or, you know, harmful or violent to your staff, if they're being racist or homophobic or transphobic, you know, any of that, that needs to be a one strike rule.
Yeah.
Because you're not providing psychological safety for your team, and you're certainly not providing wellness and mental, you know, mental wellness for your team in allowing those clients to keep coming back. If I had a client that was, you know, and I use the word violence when I think of people that are aggressive in a verbal way or that are harmful in a verbal way, that is violence. So if I had a client that was doing that, or if I had a client that even, you know, remotely said something racist or prejudice, they're gone. You know, I'm not interested in hearing you out. I'm not interested in workshopping this. I'm not interested in mediating this. Here are your records. You're not coming back here. Because you said something really terrible to my team, and I need my CSRs. I need my VAs. I need my techs. I need my doctors. I don't need you.
I was literally talking to a technician yesterday who opened up their own practice. Her husband's a vet, and she's a technician. I'm so proud of them. I'm working with them on doing a lot of amazing things. And she was sharing, because they're more recently open, and she was sharing some experiences that, because the previous owner of this practice practiced differently, we'll just say that, like, medically, progressively.
There were some discrepancies.
Yes, there we go. Beautiful. There were some discrepancies.
There were some difference in practice style.
But I was so fucking proud of her. She's like, I have the right to refuse service at any time. And again, like Aaron said, this isn't us being like, oh, this client's really upset. They're yelling, but it's because this is the way they're dealing. Not yelling at me, but they might be just like yelling or crying on the phone because we just gave them, everyone deals with things differently. That's not necessarily what we're talking about. I'm sure everyone is aware of what we're talking about. And if one of those, because she was sharing a few, and she wasn't, she's the manager, and she heard something said to her CSR, and she went up, and the amount of psychological safety that staff member has now, because how many times are we treated badly? And then I understand that they're being nice to you, but you saw what they just said to us, and you just didn't acknowledge it, or in some cases, just passed it by or didn't acknowledge it at all. So
that is the fastest way to lose and then never get back the trust and the loyalty of your team.
Yep.
Those are the type of situations where you have one chance to prove yourself and to prove where you stand on the subject. And if you don't get it right the first time, you risk losing, you know, permanent trust from those people. I want to shout out some of the really great people in vet med that are championing DEIB right now, which is Dr. Nicole Bruno, who runs BlendVet. BlendVet is a platform that teaches and certifies practices and businesses on DEIB in the vet space. Dr. Valerie Marcano is the founder of Possibilities. It's Possibilities, which focuses on mentorship in underserved communities, you know, for folks that are interested in a career in vet med or for folks that are, you know, moving forward with their careers in vet med. You can go on either of their websites and you can see a list of affinity organizations.
And you can follow them on socials. They share the most amazing resources. Yes. They are wonderful.
They have great information. They're great educators. But you can go on their website and you can find all the affinity groups that operate in vet med. That list has grown substantially in the past few years. So if you're a queer person, consider joining, like, you know, becoming a member of Pride VMC. If you're a person of color in vet med, consider joining in the National Association of Black Veterinarians or Black DVM Network, Latinx VMA. There's Asian Pacific Islander organization. There's Native American organizations, but
multicultural. Is it MVA?
Absolutely, multicultural. Yes.
So great to see that there's more and more. We're going to be sharing these in all the show notes because.
Thank you.
You guys, please check them out. Like. Follow them, share love, because they are doing some hard shit.
They really need support from their community. And I think that if you're listening, you could probably benefit from their support too. These affinity groups will get stronger, not just with your membership dues, but with your participation. You know, go to those meetings, join, pitch in, give feedback, you know, share as much of yourself as you can, so that these organizations can grow and be stronger and advocate for us better. But yeah, it's super important. And, you know, I think that in the near future, we are going to see vet med get less and less white over time. I think just as the world is becoming more diverse, as the world is becoming, you know, more cross-cultural, we're going to see that number change, but we can also do active work to bring more people of color, to bring more neurodiversity, to bring more, you know, queer and trans people, to bring more intersectionality into vet med. And that's going to be the key to building our ranks, making our practices more stable, making our, you know, closing that revolving door, building retention. All of this is tied into DEI. All of 100%. DEI is tied into belonging. So, you know, you're going to hear these words over and over again: belonging, engagement, you know, DEI. These really, really matter, and these should be a priority for your company or, you know, for your engagement platforms.
Yeah, we talked about compassionate action on the Humane Education episode with Emily, and it was all about, again, we all have feelings and things are challenging for all of us, and saying things and sharing things are helpful, but really we need to do compassionate action. I need to be emailing my senators. I need to be attending meetings. I need to become a member. So we really need to be doing that compassionate action for vet med, just to better the world, obviously, but also to better vet med, which most of my listeners, I'm imagining, you fucking love vet med, but we have some shit to work on. And I know Aaron and most to all of my guests.
I fucking love vet med.
I fucking love vet med,
that's
dude.
That's not clear.
Like, legit. I mean, but which is why we want it to be better. All my guests do. And that's what this podcast is about. Like, I fucking love vet med. I really fucking do. But we have some shit to work out.
Absolutely. You know, I hear people all the time talk about how fortunate we are to be in the veterinary field, how fortunate we are to have this really unique opportunity. And whenever I hear those people say that, I'm so torn, because the part of me that has been doing this since I was literally a teenager agrees with that. And I'm like, yeah, this is really fucking rad. Like, this is a great, like, I get to go to work and, you know, even on a bad day, I get to hang out with a dog or a cat that I really like. But that experience is not the same for everyone.
For everybody.
And not everyone feels fortunate and blessed to be in vet med, you know, especially people that are struggling with low pay, people that are struggling with toxic work environments, people that are struggling with unchecked or unsupported mental health issues. They might not be feeling that way, but we have an opportunity to fix that. We have an opportunity to make that an accurate statement for everyone. And Tabitha, I just want to say one more thing about DEI.
Oh, please.
Before I turn it into a soapbox.
I love this soapbox. Go.
When you see people that work in a DEI space, when you see people that are champions of DEI, they very often look like people of color. In vet med, I think it is women of color that really champion this the most. You see people from the communities that are championing and that are doing the work. And I just want to remind anyone that is a white, male, cis heterosexual person, if you call yourself an ally, and if you use allyship as you identify as someone who is an ally, DEI work is a great role for someone who wants to be an ally. And I want to shout out Alyssa Mages, who said on social media, I think recently, that allyship is a verb, not a noun. And I think that's really important to consider that, you know, you don't get to call yourself an ally. You don't get to make that decision, and you don't get to just make that a title that you stick with. Allyship is something that we prove on a day-to-day basis, and we prove that by doing the work.
Yeah.
So if you are, you know, someone who comes from a privileged background or someone who comes, you know, like me, I identify as queer and non-binary, but I'm also a white male. So I do come with a lot of privilege. And with that is a great opportunity for me to speak on DEI. And I'm not going to go to, you know, a group of Black veterinarians and talk to them about diversity. I'm not going to go to a group of, you know, Latinx folks and talk to them about diversity, but I can educate leaders that come from a largely, you know, white heterosexual background. I can talk to them about diversity, and I can talk to them about, you know, unconscious bias, about how to create safe, not safe spaces, but brave spaces inside their practices. So, you know, if that is you, you have an opportunity to support the DEI space too, and to take some of that burden off of, you know, the people of color, the people from marginalized backgrounds, the neurodiverse people that have been doing the brunt work of DEI pretty much up to this point.
No, I think that's a very good point. And when you're interviewing at a practice, ask about it, right? You know,
absolutely.
start the conversation, plant seeds, like everywhere you go.
Absolutely.
It's not going to change overnight, but it's not going to change if we don't do any fucking thing. So
Tabitha, that's a great point when you talk about interviewing, because, you know, we're in a moment right now to
where
the candidate is the one that has a lot of the weight when it goes to those interviews, right? There are vet practices that are hiring for doctors, and they're getting, you know, one candidate a year or one candidate every 18 months. There are vet practices that have been hiring for LVTs or credential techs, and they haven't gotten, you know, you're getting candidates trickling in. So those candidates know when they're coming in that they've got, you know, the ball is in their court, so to speak. And I think when you're going on these interviews, you should be interviewing the practice that you're going to work at. So ask those tough questions, ask them about their diversity initiatives, ask them, you know, where is the diversity in your practice, or where is the diversity in your organization? Ask them where the money comes from. You know, a lot of the consolidators these days really kind of fit into three groups. There's vet-owned consolidators, there's private equity, and then there's like family and wealth funds. So knowing where the money comes from is really important. You can use websites like techcrunch.com to see, you know, where funding is coming from, to know, you know, like where are these corporations getting their money, who's involved from a private equity standpoint. Vetintegrations.com is a great website for you to go and see where all the vet consolidators are. It really breaks down, you know, each consolidator, and it tells you like when they were formed, who founded the organization, where does the money come from, and, you know, what is their niche, or where do they practice out of? So those are two really good resources for finding out, you know, about the funding side of the company that you're looking into.
And if the if they are, let's say they aren't as aware, unfortunately, many people aren't, which is very surprising, but we have to be kind in some context. Let's say they aren't aware of DEI, right? Which let's real talk. This is happening.
It's an emerging resource, and yes, more and more people are finding out about it, but it's still, you know, and that's perfectly fine. We have an opportunity to educate around it.
Exactly. And see their response, right?
Absolutely.
That way, because again, yes, could I shame them and not be helpful? Yes. But is that going to be fairly productive? And obviously you have to be in the mental health space. I understand all of that context, but you know, that person may not be. I deal with a lot of people who aren't aware of it, and we have conversations and I plant seeds, and then they start to see the world as it actually is. But if I would have just shamed them or whatever, that wouldn't have been as productive. So if.
Well, it's like Jonathan Van Ness says, you want to call people in, don't call them out.
Yes.
Oh, and education takes time, and exactly, growth takes time. It's not linear. You know, people often think that growth is an arrow that just kind of points up, yes, and out, but it's, you know, it took me 22 years in this field to get to where I am today. And I, yeah, definitely did not start, you know, with this same sense and understanding that I have now. Growth and development and education take time, and it's a process that we just have to continue to work at and continue to push and continue to advocate for.
Yes, yes, yes. So what a wonderful conversation. Loved all of it. I always end the podcast. I might change it. You might have inspired me to change it. I always end the podcast by asking the guest, what is something that currently makes them happy? This could be the fact that it's 60 degrees in Ohio right now. It also makes me sad though, but also it makes me happy. And then also,
it's
what's
55 and sunny in Queens
right now.
I know,
what's happening?
The minute we get off here, I'm taking my dog Coquito to the park, and he's going to get a full day's worth of sun.
Oh, that's a happy thing. But also, what's something crappy? Happy crappy. Ooh. I love it.
So I would say that my happy is the weather. My happy is, you know, I don't have much going on the rest of the day, so I'm going to spend the day with my dog. My crappy, I don't really have a crappy today, Tabitha. Honestly, like, this recording has just given me so much life. And for those that don't know, and for those that haven't figured it out by now, this is my first ever podcast recording.
And didn't he do wonderful, guys? Yes. Everyone's well, applauding. We'll see. Everyone's applauding at home.
We'll let the masses judge, but I do want to thank you for popping my cherry, Tabitha. You were very gentle at first, which is how I like it.
You like it. Mm.
That's right. So yeah, I don't have a crappy today. And you know, it's not many days that I get to say that. So thank you for giving me a crapless day.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And thank you so much for coming on and bringing on your amazing knowledge. And I'm sure we'll have you back, because I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much,
Anytime.
Aaron.
Anytime. It has been a real pleasure. And I'm excited to have these conversations anytime I get a chance. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Such an awesome conversation with Aaron. How is your practice supporting you and setting you up for success? I would love to hear at talesfromavettech@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we would appreciate a review so we can reach more people. Thanks for listening, everybody.